You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you so much for joining us. According to the Department of Veteran Affairs, an estimated 11% of veterans deployed to Afghanistan and 20% of those deployed to Iraq have PTSD. The National Institute of Health puts that number higher. Nearly a third of female veterans report experiencing military sexual trauma, which is a term the Department of Veteran Affairs uses to refer to sexual assault or repeated threatening sexual harassment. There are groups seeking to help veterans in creative and meaningful ways. One of those groups is profiled in a new film called We Are Not Done Yet, which premieres on HBO tonight at 8 p.m. The film captures a group of veterans as they rehearse for a performance at the Landsberg Theater in downtown D.C. The piece they're working on is a collective poem about trauma. We Are Not Done Yet is produced by Jeffrey Wright, who also directed the actual piece that's for the stage. Many of you know him through his most recent role in HBO's hit series Westworld. I will always remember you as Basquiat. Jeffrey, nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
Also joining us is April Harris. She's a veteran who spent 26 years in the U.S. Army, and she shares her story in the film. April, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
So, Jeffrey, as we get to meet these veterans in the film, and we get to see them start to work on this collective piece, you're the director, and you're trying to help them as performers. So I have a two-part question. The first part is, what did you want to help your performers accomplish? And then the second part is, you, Jeffrey, the human being, what did you hope would be accomplished?
Well, I think those two things overlap. Mm-hmm. I really just wanted to assist them in being heard, and that was their desire. They have been using poetry and the written word to examine trauma, to process it, and to heal, not only heal themselves, but also heal one another. And one of the aspects of that boosts the effectiveness is doing it together and doing it in public. And so I was asked down, and I met Sima Reza, this poet who leads these exercises, and it was very clear to me that there was a real simple kind of singular mission here, and that was to be heard, because they feel that their voices are not heard. We hear the troops and the veterans spoken of via the politician's voice, via, you know, the campaign slogans and the ads that we see, but we rarely hear from the veterans themselves. And so that was it for me. That was what I was trying to do as a director, was make sure that their voices were as clear and powerful as possible on that stage. And really, as a human being, that was my mission too. So.
How did you get first involved?
Well, over time, okay. I think I kind of grew up and became a little more aware of and respectful of the folks who serve our country. There were experiences and relationships that led to that. I went to Sierra Leone in 2001 during the war. There was a ceasefire at the time, but it was the first time I'd been in a war zone, and it really shook me up to a lot of things that I took for granted, that we take for granted in this country: security, those who restore order when security breaks down. I ended up working there over a number of years, traveling 3-4 times a year, built relationships with people who had been affected by the war, who had fought in the war. I started a foundation that was led by a retired major general from the U.S. Army named Frederick Lay, who was a Vietnam vet, infantryman. He passed away, unfortunately, about a month ago, 2 days before our first public screening of this film. And he had come down to talk to the vets, too, about his experiences. And he was such an incredible partner of mine that he'd like to support what I did. And so building that relationship, building the other relationships, the experiences, just led me to be more curious. Mm-hmm. And so I had an opportunity, was doing a reading of a program called Theater of War. A guy named Brian Dorries uses the Greek tragedies as a means of promoting conversation around PTSD in a contemporary setting. He argues that the Greeks were a warrior society that gathered around stories about the victories of war, but also stories about the consequences of war on the human psyche. And so we did one of these readings down in D.C. There were some folks from the Pentagon there, and I said, is there any more I can do? And I got a call a couple months later, and they put me in touch with Sima, And she said, hey, one of our vets wants to put on a staged reading of collective poems that they have written, and would you come down and work with them? And I said, well, you know, I haven't served in the military, but I've served on the stage. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I just loaded up my backpack with those experiences and came down to join them in this mission.
April, why did you join the military?
I joined the military to get out of Omaha, Nebraska. It wasn't about patriotism at all. I had several uncles that had served. My grandfather had served. I was raised on a hard work ethic, mm-hmm. Honesty, loyalty, which are many of the values in the Army. But it really was just trying to figure out a way to work and pay for school.
What part of the military, your experience, do you still hold dear that's important to you? And then what part of your experience was the most difficult?
If I could start with the part that's the most difficult.
Sure.
I was just sitting here thinking about it. When 9/11 hit, my hatred for what I loved and served at that time for almost maybe 10 or more years. So they closed down the base. But I was at work on base, and my children were in school on base. So when they put us on lockdown, they sent the kids home, mm-hmm. and my kids were home alone. And I was there with America's sons and daughters and protecting them and keeping them safe, and nobody was home with my children.
With your babies, right?
Yeah. And then the flip side of that is why I loved what I did and why I'd do it all over again is because those that I served. It was my comrades, my servicemen that I was honored to take care of and protect and maintain their health and welfare. I'd do it all over again. Hmm. That's why I'm here today, because I'm still serving them.
When you got involved with this process, did you realize how much it was going to bring up for you when you got involved with this performance therapy?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Were you ready for that?
I had been doing it a while since I was seeking healing mm-hmm. at any means necessary. I got a taste of healing, and you couldn't have stopped me. But these group of people, SEMA and the team, to do it in that form, I've only done it with civilians. Outside of the military setting, this was my first time doing it within that confine.
People who understood, who
right.
knew, right?
So, yeah, it was different because, you know, we tell our story to the civilian side and they're ooh and on, but there's no progression mm-hmm. because you're going to coddle me. You're sad, and I respect that. But it's just like being on the battlefield with my teammates. You get in there, we talk about it, we get gritty, and we say, okay, now what? Where are we going now? Mm-hmm. And to be able to do that with them, to fight this darkness with the team, sis, it was phenomenal.
I saw Gloria Steinem speak last night, and one of the things she talked about in the fight for women's rights was the idea of community.
Yes.
And you have to fight together.
Yes.
And so that's interesting, you describing using the creativity to fight.
Yes.
Fight the demons and
yes.
the trauma. Jeffrey, one of the things about acting is you have to be so vulnerable. That's the whole part of it, right? You just open yourself wide up, and you have all these folks who have all these difficulties and these difficult memories and difficult lives. Some of them are still in it. How did you and SEMA make these folks feel safe?
Well, I think we approached it with a great deal of respect. There was some empathy in there. And I won't hesitate to say that there was a lot of love in the room. And there was a desire on their part to open up, not so much so initially. There was some resistance, but there was a desire to be in that space. And we took that energy and took that desire and allowed it to blossom, allowed it to open up. We talk about this this idea of community. That was obviously an important tool for us, that we had folks there together. But the opportunity we have now is to build this community and enlarge it, enlarge the circle, inclusive of military folk, but also going back to this idea of the Greeks gathering around these stories. We don't do that in America. We gather around the celebration and the hoopla and all of that and the rhetoric, but we don't gather around the consequences and the pain. And so the idea, the opportunity we have now with this film airing tonight on HBO at 8 p.m. is to expand that community so that it's inclusive of those of us who have the luxury yes. of changing the channel on the reports from the war zones when these veterans do not have that luxury. We need, as a society, to take on that burden, to take on the burden of their trauma and their pain, because we are complicit in it. Mm-hmm. And they have been deployed in our name, in the name of our country, and when they come back, we need to receive them in the name of our country, as individuals, in a collective. So we begin to start that process a little bit tonight, mm-hmm. I hope, and contribute in an insignificant way to that.
The name of the film is We Are Not Done Yet. It premieres tonight on HBO at 8 p.m. I'm speaking with Jeffrey Wright and April Harris about the film. I'm interested in the process a little bit, and you can jump in here to April. At one point, a lot of people have all kinds of difficulties. There's substance abuse. There's people's marriage has fallen apart. They have one gentleman has a child who's autistic. He's trying to raise the child. He can't talk to his family about it. And at one point, one of the veterans breaks down on stage. It just gets to be too much. Mm-hmm. Did that happen a lot during the process?
No, that was a particular spike in the anxiety. Yeah. It was, you know, I'd ask them at the end of this piece to just hold at the front of the stage because I wanted the audience to take them in after these stories had been told. Music comes in, but I wanted them to settle. And we hadn't talked about that, but it occurred to me as I was watching them in this dress rehearsal, just settle. Just let them see you. Let them hear them. Let hear these stories in their heads. Let them feel you. And that was just a little too much for, mm-hmm. for one of our folks. And she let it be known and said, okay, all right, let's step back. But during the performance, she came out and the first thing she said, it's not in the film, but the first thing she said was, because it was such an intense a number of stories and the intensity of the emotion, she said, hey, it's kind of heavy here tonight, huh? She said, I'm the comic relief. And mm-hmm. from there, she improvised mm-hmm. this story of her background in Virginia and what it meant to her to join the military and what had happened to her in Afghanistan when this base that she was a part of was attacked. And she just crushed it. She mm-hmm. just brought it home. And it was seeing the difficulties, but more so what we saw, what we experienced, and what we celebrate are the victories, because they just soldiered on.
But
in
I'm
the best
glad
way.
It was in the film, because it made the film more realistic. If it had all been
yes.
sort of lemonade and cookies, it yes. would have, I really was, I was like, where, I know somebody is gonna, this is gonna be yeah. a lot for somebody.
Yes.
So I appreciated that was left mm-hmm. in the film.
Well, in some respects, that was one reason that we did the film. The film was an accident in some ways. We were there focused on this theatrical event. There happened to be a woman named Serene Haribedian who had been invited by SEMA to film the process, I think after the first week or so that I came down, first 1 or 2 weeks, and she was doing it to bear witness to what was happening and also perhaps to create a short film that would promote this work.
Mm-hmm.
When we finished the performance, it was one of the most powerful nights I've ever had in the theater, and we were talking, I was thinking in my head about maybe we do a tour of this, maybe we mm-hmm. take this show on the road, but it was an unconventional, unorthodox show, and it was difficult. There were also logistical concerns and things like that, and so the next morning, when I thought the better of that idea, I called Serene. I said, Serene, would you show us what you've been filming over there in the corner? And
light bulbs went off.
She showed me this stuff. It was so gorgeous, so poetic in its visual sensibility. She captured the essence of what was happening so comprehensively. I said, I think we have something that's mm-hmm. much bigger here. And the decision was made. I said, I think if we can get portraits of some of these folks, understand a little more deeply who they are, that we might have a story that we can share on a broader stage. And so HBO agreed.
If I could say something about the process, what you just said just gave me the visual of what this kind of work can do if we come together. So she felt unsafe about where we were at because we've been doing work in another location. Mm-hmm. And so Jeffrey and Seema and Serene, they put us in a position where we felt safe. safety, and then she had her tribe. So she had an opportunity to work through whatever issue she had. We were not going to go on stage without our battle buddy. We were not going to be in an environment where she didn't feel comfortable. We didn't have to say much. She did the work. We just gave her the space to do it. That's what healing is about. If we can do that in families, if we can do that in communities, just imagine change.
If we can do that on a national level.
Wow.
If we can embrace and provide that level of support and understanding, we'll solve problems with our veterans that have been generational. But I'm not sure the will is there yet.
Right.
But it needs to be.
Right. It didn't cost us much, and I didn't have to lose any of myself to give to my sister.
Mm-hmm.
Huge.
You were very candid in your interviews about being a victim of sexual harassment and sexual assault while you were serving. What do you hope that someone who sees your interview, what would you want them to know about you? Because you're more than just a victim of sexual assault. You're a mom, and you're a veteran, and snappy dresser.
I'm a beautiful woman.
Rockstar.
What I want to represent is hope. I'm very spiritual, and how I got here is just not for April. It can be for someone else too. Just hope. I don't want to keep saying that you're not alone, because I don't want to. It just doesn't feel good to say that. But we represent hope. You can get through this. What do you need?
Mm-hmm.
Tell us what you need. And the resources. This program has been phenomenal. Arts has gotten me to where I am today. I would not be sitting here. I wouldn't have the relationship opportunity that I have to be a mother to my wonderful sons without this art. But art has supplemented my evidence-based treatment program. I think that's a perfect way to say it. Mm-hmm. It has supplement. I wouldn't be here without it.
What does the title mean? We are not done yet.
We're not done. Oh, look at us now. We're not done yet. And we're not even done doing what we're doing now. It's not over, and this is for all of us.
You know, I call April a rock star. She's a rock star of selflessness and responsibility, and that's what I was so struck by in working with these folks. You notice how she talks about representing others. They talk about using this pain, this injury, these experiences as tools now to reach out to others who understand, who have similar experiences, and can grab on to what they bring to the table as a means of self-healing for themselves. It's just, it speaks to who they are. It also speaks, I think, to how they honor the best side of the culture of the military. I'm just so proud of them. And they have taught me so much in this process.
You learn a lot watching the film tonight, because you're going to watch it tonight. It's called We Are Not Done Yet. It's on HBO at 8 p.m. April Harris, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Harris, thanks for coming in.
Jeffrey Wright.
Jeffrey Wright. Oh, April Harris. April Harris, Jeffrey Wright. This is all
about Allison
Stewart. Stay with us. This is all of it. I'm Allison Stewart. Back in September, I had the chance to talk with playwright, professor, and performer Daniel Alexander Jones. Daniel's show Blacklight has been running at the Greenwich House Theater, and this weekend is closing weekend. The show is a tour de force performance wherein Daniel's alter ego, Jomama Jones, owns the night. Jomama commands your attention. She's a grand diva who sparkles on stage and a legendary singer who channels the influences of Prince, Sade, Diana Ross, and Tina Turner, among others. Let's take a listen back to our conversation. Daniel Alexander Jones, welcome to All of It.
Thank you. It's so good to be here with you.
She is all of it.
Oh, yes, she really is. She really is.
She's definitely all of it.
Yeah.
Now, you're someone who makes live art.
Yes.
And
yes.
Jomama is an example of that art. Where did she come to be? How did she come to be? Where was she born?
I love it. In order to answer that, I have to tell you very briefly where I was born. So I come from Springfield, Mass., which is a working class city in Western Massachusetts. And I grew up in the 1970s and 80s in a beautiful mixed community that was primarily a black community of Southern migrant blacks, right? Mm-hmm. Along with European immigrants as well. I went to public school, and the fabric of that community was incredibly loving, incredibly political, incredibly intelligent, but working class. Mm-hmm. And we loved our music. You know, so I had the radio was always on. You heard every different kind of music coming out of people's houses. And in particular, I loved black music and these singers that you're mentioning. And so when, in my 20s, I was working on a performance piece that sort of talked about that cultural and political reality, I wanted to have a section in it that talked about Soul Train, because we would all watch Soul Train and learn the dances and do what you do.
Don,
you know,
Cornelius.
Exactly.
Yes.
Keep up with it. You know, and I wanted to put someone in the center of that section, but I didn't want to impersonate one of those great performers. And all of a sudden, like, boom, out of the sky, Jomama appeared in full form with a backstory, with her own energy. And she was both an aggregate of those singers, but also of so many of the black women that I grew up around who were incredibly brave, incredibly smart, and took nothing from the world. They brooked no nonsense, mm-hmm. right? And so that was about 1995 when she appeared.
And she, you mentioned she has a whole world, a backstory. Where is she from? Where does she currently live?
Yeah, well, she lives now between New York and somewhere in Europe. She says Switzerland, you know? And I listen to her. I channel her more than I create her, if that makes sense. And I think she represents somebody who grew up in the North, in an urban environment, but then who also has roots down South, which is certainly an important part of this particular mm-hmm. show, is the relationship between those two worlds. And I think that generation that came of age post-civil rights, that has those roots of the people who actually went through that journey and made that migration North.
Yeah, I always tell people, you know, my parents went to segregated schools, and I'm not a dinosaur.
Right? Exactly.
And so if you're this sort of close. In this age between like 35 and 55, you kind of have a hand in both worlds. You want to look forward to all the things that could be and all the dynamic young people out there doing what they do, but also knowing what the roots of that are not that far away.
Absolutely.
You've described her as coming through you. How does that work? Do you meditate? Do you all of a sudden start writing? How does that work?
Yeah, it's a process where it's almost like her spirit drops into me. And there's a weird thing when I'm making work where we're both kind of together, if that makes sense. I feel her presence. I can kind of tap into things that she sees or ways that she might see. I can tap into memory, if you will. And then when it's time to perform, I gotta go. Like, she kicks me all the way out. Anyone who has worked with me on the show knows there's a moment where Joe arrives and Daniel is gone. And I don't actually have anything to do with what happens on that stage. And it's very different. Like, I'm a very controlling person with my other artwork. I wish I could take credit for this. But there's something else going on here that feels like a metaphysical connection.
What would happen if you pushed back? If Daniel pushed back at Jomama?
She doesn't care. She says no. You know, I've written whole things for her that she just tosses out, you know? And what I recognize is that there's something, I think it goes to some of those performance traditions that are ancient traditions, really, about mask work and what does it mean to allow a persona to lead in a performative setting. And that's what I try to do, is I actually try to get out of the way.
It's interesting you bring up the mask work, because that's part of if you take any courses in theater or the history mm-hmm. of theater. Could you share a little bit about the history of mask work?
Absolutely, absolutely. So I would say that, you know, in many traditions, and I had a great professor at Brown University, John Amy, with whom I got to study, who is an expert in this area, you know, that the idea is not that you are putting on something that is false to obscure who you are. But the idea is that with many traditions in Asia and Africa, that the mask itself is representative of forces in nature, for example, or of archetypes. Mm-hmm. And that in that mask, in the actual construction of it, in the kind of meditative work of the maker, it's imbued with the force of that stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And that when you, the performer, take that mask on or put that mask on, you're actually welcoming the stories that come with it. You're welcoming the energies that come with it. And it is a kind of dance with an entity, right? That it seems a little abstract, but it's a different kind of text, if you will, from a written text. It's a text that's about a location, a personality, or a set of information that can lead you down a journey that you aren't going to know beforehand. So there's a lot of improvisatory work, spontaneity. In many ways, I feel it connects to, you know, jazz as well. Like every night, Jo Mama says something different to the audience. There are ways that she will move in the room that are about that particular night. So that mask, if you will, is alive. It's not a dead thing.
So interesting. This is a sidebar tangent. One of my favorite things about the film Black Panther is a spaceship. When it lifts up, you realize it's an African mask.
You know it's right?
The bottom,
that's
right?
Yeah.
I was like,
this
has got something serious to it. All right, back to your interview. A lot of people, I've heard people, I listened to some interviews with you, and they sort of ask you very tentatively, this isn't a drag show. Mm-hmm. They're sort of frightened to ask you about that.
Yeah, I don't know where the fear comes from.
Why do you think they're frightened to ask you? Well, because it's not a drag show. We should just say that out front.
Right. I think all things to do with identity, politics, and how we articulate are very charged. So I can understand why it would be, people want to be respectful of every individual's journey. But for me, drag is a very particular tradition, for which I have great respect. And I think there are artists who live in that tradition who are carrying it forward in really remarkable ways. This is simply not what I'm doing. And so I always want to just contextualize it in terms of what I'm actually about and what you're going to experience. The hope here is that you are going to come into contact with Jo Mama Jones, who exists, and I am merely the vessel for that to happen. I'm like the house, and I'm not the point. Whereas with drag, I think there's a beautiful and intentional relationship between the performer's own being and their persona and the audience. It's like a multi-layered cake.
Is she fictional?
She is fictional in the sense that, you know, she is not based on any factual story, but she doesn't feel fictional to me. You know, she is a presence, and anyone who's been in my life since she came into being has their own relationship with her. All of my friends know her, and they're aware of when I'm about to go into working on a project or about to go into performance. They can kind of tell I get a little fuzzy at the edges, and she's around. Yeah.
We're speaking with Daniel Alexander Jones about his new show, Black Light. It's not a new show. It's a reimagining of a show that you've done before, and Jo Mama Jones, his alter ego. I've only seen the recent iteration of the show. Mm-hmm. Does it change? Does the subject matter change, or is the basic storyline, the same storyline through?
It is the same storyline, the same core. Mm-hmm. What changed is, I think, because we had this incredible luxury of 6 weeks of running it earlier in the year, we learned so much from our engagement with audiences, and we got so many great questions about the subject matter and got to see how it resonated with people as we deal with the craziness in our country right now. It helped us to open up new questions and to respond to those things. So there are a couple new songs and new ways that we move through the material to try to keep it relevant to the actual moment we're in.
The show is, I'm going to try to describe it a little bit, and please fill in the blanks. It's part cabaret show, part history lesson, a part of a meditation about what it means to live in the world at this moment, who you're going to be in the world at this moment. You mentioned that you made some changes based on what we're experiencing now. What were some of those changes?
Yeah, well, we added a new song, which I wrote with my wonderful collaborator, Josh Quat, who plays guitar in my band. It's called See Things As They Are. And one of the big things was that we realized in our conversation with folks how hard it is to stand inside of the maelstrom of what we're experiencing right now on an intimate level for individuals. It's a lot. You know, I think everybody, and I say in the show, like, no matter what part of the so-called political spectrum you find yourself on, this is a very tough moment in terms of being able to integrate the constant flow of challenge that we're experiencing. Mm-hmm. And so we meditated on that, and this idea of the necessity of taking time to really remove the rose-colored glasses, but also to remove the doomsday voice, to really look with clear eyes at what's actually going on so that we can make certain decisions about how we want to move forward and move toward productive change, but not with illusion anymore. We have to let go of the cloudy gaze, mm-hmm. I think. And that comes, I think, when it's overwhelming, when it's emotionally overwhelming. So one of my hopes is that this show can be a place. Theater is the seeing place, right? Like, that's the root of that term. That we can, as living beings, come together in that room for the 90 minutes we're together and be willing to hold space for one another to see and feel what we're actually going through together.
It's not a passive experience to go see this show. Jemima comes off the stage. She walks around, direct eye contact with people. Mm-hmm. Have you ever had someone, has she ever had someone who just didn't want to, just didn't want to engage?
Yes. Oh, yeah. That happens.
What happens after that? She doesn't strike me as someone who takes no for an answer.
She doesn't, really. But I think she also understands that, again, we're all in different places, parts of the journey, you know, and that part of coming together for this purpose is that we understand sometimes you hit a limit, you hit a wall. Not today, not me, you know. But I also think it's interesting for the room to experience that, because the room also takes note when someone doesn't want to participate. And we have to hold that, too. That's part of the truth of our experience. Some people don't want to go along for the ride.
Does she ad-lib through the show?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, there's some things that are set, but again, I think of it like jazz. You know,
you have
like,
to know the notes. You have to hit your mark to get the light.
Exactly. And there's a certain, you know, you're going to tell this particular story. But that night, you know, one of my favorite quotes of all time is from the great jazz artist Betty Carter. And as she said, I never listen to my own recordings because I would run the risk of repeating myself. And I feel that way. Like, I know what I'm going to do, but I never want to know exactly how it's going to deploy on a given night, because it would mean that, you know, Joe wasn't fully present. I want her to be present. And she has different things to say.
Different nights, different things.
Yeah.
So, Daniel, Blacklight has been described as a fusion of Black American freedom movement, Afro-mysticism, mm-hmm. and goddess mythology. What is Afro-mysticism?
Yes, so Afro-mysticism is a term that I've been exploring a lot of late, looking at the ways in which Black culture, Black American culture in particular, really opens up space for us to experience the numinous, the divine, at the same time that we are working on with our feet on the ground. It is, to me, that transcendent moment that we experience in religious spaces. I think about gospel music. I think about, of course, like the recent loss of Aretha Franklin and what would happen when you heard her sing. But I also think about jazz music. And I also think about street parties. And I also think about rent parties. And I also think about the kinds of beautiful commingling in communities that happen when people tell stories and listen to one another's travails and offer connection. There's a lift that happens. And it's connected to Afrofuturism in the sense that I think it's about envisioning what might be possible. But I've been interested in the ways that it differs in centering Blackness as a productive and generative space that is not contingent upon the kind of dire, often apocalyptic visions that attend Afrofuturism. Not that those aren't real, right? You know, at all. But I'm saying, what is the technology that has gotten us through? What has gotten us over? And how might we begin to articulate that in our work to own it even more fully, especially for a younger generation? You know, we spoke a little earlier about, you know, we're in that interesting bridge generation who knew those older folk and knew the civil rights folk, and then who are witnessing these incredible young artists and people and activists coming up and doing work. And I hope that part of this work can bridge and reintroduce some of those older technologies, if you will, to younger audiences.
Jemima tells the story about her awakening as a young girl, to being a northern girl, a little fresh, doesn't necessarily understand why she's got to go visit her elders in the South, and then ultimately, I don't want to give too much away, discovers about their history and how they fought for their rights and the losses they had as a result of fighting for their rights. Why, you know, the show is very joyous and then it makes this very serious turn. In terms of pacing and in creating the show, how did you decide when to make that serious turn?
Yeah, it's really an intuitive thing. And for me, it follows the flow of the kind of storytelling and the kind of visiting. Like, I think of it, you come to visit with Jo Mama, right? Mm-hmm. And she's visiting with you. And I think about, you know, again, in my neighborhood, both my parents came up in the Boys and Girls Clubs of America. My grandmother ran the Girls Club. I was always around people in the community. You would come down on Saturday morning, you never knew who was going to be at our kitchen table, and they were there to tell. So you wake up to laughter very often, and you go listen to the conversation as a kid. Sometimes, you know, you weren't supposed to be there to listen to it. But the conversation would begin with that laughter and wild stories. But invariably, it would settle into whatever was on the heart of the person who was coming to visit, which was often a very serious thing. It may be a breakup. It may be a loss. It may be some turn in their life that presented them with great challenge, or politics mm-hmm. of the day. And it would get heavy in the room. But it got heavy because you had that lightness. They had made the space to hold it. And then my parents would invariably find a way to move the energy and to help move that person to a place where they felt like they could get up and go back out and do what they needed to do. So on some level, that's coded in my DNA from being a little kid, that shape. You make the space, you welcome people, there's a lot of joy. The joy isn't false, but the joy is the thing that you need to cross the threshold to what's serious. And then you take care of business.
As my mom used to say, that she had an Aunt Leola out in Bed-Stuy, who you never knew, somebody who needed a meal was always going to be in the house.
That's right.
When you went to visit, because that's what you did for neighbors, and that's what you did for the neighborhood.
That's right.
The show is dynamic, and there's costume changes, and there's light, and all this. And then there's this very straightforward a cappella song, mm-hmm. and you've agreed, Jo Mama's agreed to sing it for us today.
Absolutely.
So if you could set it up, and then I'm going to let you go.
Yes, it's the, as you said, the second song. It's called Shattered, and it asks us to look at things as they are. Language made to liberate, now used to assassinate. The freeing impulse of the soul and shame us into silence. Comfort sought at every turn, to suffering all blind eyes turn, and never once a sacrifice. Instead you say, it's not your problem. Concepts of identity consume us like a cruel disease, impede our vulnerability, confuse our hearts for matter. Generations maimed and sidelined, till the flame is gone from their eyes. Once resilient spirits now are shattered. All the bones swept under rugs are poking out from under edges. Blatant lies told to disguise the truthful tale of nations. Rage and greed and fear and vengeance, righteous dominating power, are the contents, we are told, of every human's nature. Take one last look in the mirror, see the mask reflected there. Was it worth it? Ask yourself, has your illusions shattered? All illusions. Shatter.
I'm speaking with Daniel Alexander Jones about his show Black Light, starring his alter ego Jo Mama Jones. In the song, you ask a lot of questions. In the show, you ask a lot of questions. You ask of the audience, what if I told you will be brave enough? What if I told you you're not alone? What if I told you it's going to be all right? What if I told you not yet? What do you want the audience to take away from these questions?
My hope is that people will leave the show understanding that the questions may be the most important thing to guide us forward. The hardest questions, the questions we're not necessarily willing to ask in mixed company, the questions that may unsettle us, and that by asking those questions, we make space again to feel all that we need to feel individually and collectively, and to make choices at what we call the crossroads, which is the central image of the show, that will lead us forward. But we can't do that if we're not willing to ask the hard questions that lead us to the hard truths.
Daniel Alexander Jones, it was a pleasure to have you in the studio
today.
It was
a joy to be here.
Thank you so much for coming on Down for All of It.
All right. Joy to see you.
Sometimes there is magic.
You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Every generation gets its celebrity mega trial, and we have one now in Brooklyn, sort of. It's for Joaquin El Chapo Guzman, the brutal cartel leader who has evaded authorities in plots hatched out of a Jerry Bruckheimer film. Now his trial is about to get underway, and the prosecution, defense, and jury selection has become an international story. Keegan Hamilton is the writer and producer at Vice News and host of the Vice News podcast Chapo Kingpin on Trial. I'm pleased to have you back on the show. I need another episode to drop soon. When does that happen?
We just had one come out on Tuesday, and then the following Tuesday we'll have another
one. Okay, because I got to already hear that one. I need a new one next week. All right, so I've been following your Twitter feed, Keegan, and it has been remarkably entertaining and interesting, the jury selection going on in the El Chapo trial. What kind of questions are people being asked, first of all, in the voir dire?
So they already sent out a questionnaire to all of the prospective jurors in advance that took care of a lot of the standard business of what do you know about El Chapo? Some also like out of left field questions like what's your favorite book and why? Once they got those people into the courtroom, it was asking questions based off of that questionnaire. So you said you saw the show on Netflix. What do you remember about that? And would that affect your ability to judge the evidence in this case? That was sort of the standard stuff. And then every once in a while, there'd be something totally out of left field. Like, you know, you said you're about to go on tour. Would this affect your job? And then they say, oh, I'm a Michael Jackson impersonator. Yeah, this would affect my job. And
there was a Michael Jackson impersonator?
Believe it or not, there was a Michael Jackson impersonator who was dropped from the jury pool because they were worried that his profession was so unique that because this jury is supposed to be anonymous, that they would be able to identify him because there's, I guess, only a handful of Michael Jackson impersonators out there.
Who are out touring. So that's a big part of this, is that a lot of the jury is going to be anonymous. The judge announced that months ago. Does that seem to be a concern of people in the jury pool?
There was a pretty substantial number of people who expressed, you know, concerns, fears about their safety for being on this jury. In most cases, those people were you know, excused from the jury just because you don't want to be judging the guilt or innocence of someone who you think would kill you. On the other hand, there were probably an equal number of people who seemed, you know, not outwardly eager, but willing, very, very willing to be a part of this. Maybe because, you know, they've heard about El Chapo and want to get all the full story, all the evidence that appears in the courtroom. Maybe because they think they're in for some trial of the century kind of thing and just want to be a part of that experience.
What questions seem to be eliminating people?
The safety concern was a big one. And then the economic hardship was another one, because this trial is going to last anywhere from 2 to 4 months. And some folks said that their employer wouldn't pay them for the duration of that, and they couldn't, you know, survive if they didn't get that income. They're only getting, I think, 40 or 50
bucks a day.
40
right?
or 50 bucks a day.
So when people are asked certain questions about El Chapo, there have been some interesting responses. Can you share some of those?
Yeah, there was a lot of it was interesting. Obviously, they selected against the people who were super familiar with him. They didn't want people who knew too much. So you got a range of people who were like, I think he's a drug lord, but I don't know anything else about him. Or I heard that his daughters had some lavish birthday party. I heard he had tunnels. I heard he escaped and they caught him, but I don't really know anything else about it. Those were the most sort of the gamut of responses. But then you got people who were very sort of he sounds familiar. And then later on, we find out that that guy had asked one of the court security officers if he could get El Chapo's autograph.
Oh my God.
He knew who he was, and he was just being a little disingenuous so that he might be able to get on this jury.
Apparently, there's an El Chapo sandwich that came up.
That was perhaps the most bizarre moment of this whole thing.
Describe it.
One of the prospective jurors said that he'd heard of El Chapo because the deli near his work had a sandwich on the menu called the El Chapo. And then, the lawyers asked, well, what is this sandwich? Which it didn't really have a clear explanation for why it was called that. It was cream cheese, lox, capers, and something spicy on a bagel.
Oh, so it's vaguely racist on the edge as well.
And the guy says, I don't know why it's called that, but it's delicious. And then later on, that was used as a reason to dismiss him because he said, I think the workers at my deli will be able to know that I'm on this jury because I mentioned the El Chapo sandwich and it got extensive coverage in the press.
Well, they ultimately were able to seat a jury, but I know at least one person was already trying to get off of it.
Yes, they picked 12 people and 6 alternates. And one of the women who was among the 12, shortly after they left the courtroom when the judge announced that they would be members of the jury, he left and had a private conversation with her and came back and said that she was in tears, worried about what was going to happen if she served on this jury. And he asked the prosecution and the defense if they would want her dismissed because of that. And both sides said, no, if we let one person go because they're crying and afraid, that might open the floodgates and everyone who doesn't want to serve for 4 months could, you know, just cry a little bit and get off. So she is, for now, at least one of the 12 people on the jury.
They're being so serious about the anonymity and the security that there's only a certain number of reporters who were even let in for this jury selection process, right?
Correct. They allowed in 5 pool reporters each day, and that was done because there were concerns that if there were the courtroom was packed with media, that when the jurors were asked sort of sensitive personal questions or about controversial things, they would be less than truthful, knowing that everything they said would be reported in the press. So each day it was 5 pool reporters, and I was one of those 5 on all 3 days of jury selection.
So once the jury was seated, obviously the jurors have numbers rather than names. Can you describe some of the jurors?
You know, it was a very interesting microcosm of Brooklyn, Long Island, Queens, Staten Island, which is the Eastern District where this case is. So you had a good number of immigrants, including some who made it onto the final jury. There was a woman from Poland, a woman from Ethiopia, a South Asian man were in there. A lot of folks had relatives who were in law enforcement, either in the Department of Corrections, the NYPD, or the Department of Homeland Security was in there. And then there were a healthy number of Spanish speakers as well. I think there were 3 fluent Spanish speakers and 1 person who said she was pretty decent at Spanish, but not fluent.
Oh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. About the Spanish speaking part.
That was one of the questions that came up a lot. And one of the things that the judge asked them, because they expect a lot of the witnesses to testify in mm-hmm. Spanish, if they could set aside their knowledge of Spanish and only listen to what the courtroom interpreter was saying in English. And one of the women, was kind of like, what do you mean? And she gave an example, like, if I hear this woman say that the apple is yellow, but I know the apple is green, I'm going to question that and not understand it. And Chapo is in the courtroom sitting there listening mm-hmm. to all this. And he thought that was pretty funny. He actually chuckled a little bit when he's like, of course, she's not going to believe when she knows that it's wrong.
You're right. That's so interesting. How did the jurors react to him being there?
You know, most people were just looking at the judge. They were seated across from the judge, and the lawyers were off to their right with Chapo. And, you know, some people looked over at him, I think, a little nervously, but he wasn't, you didn't get the sense that he was trying to intimidate anyone. He was sitting there being attentive, you know, writing notes and listening to the whole proceeding through an interpreter.
What was the final makeup of the jury?
It is 7 women and 5 men. And I believe the alternates, it's 4 women and 2 men.
And what's the age range approximately?
It runs the gamut. There were folks who looked like they were in their maybe mid to late 20s, all the way up to folks who appeared to be sort of in their 60s or so.
What's the next step now the jury has been seated.
So they're off for the rest of the week, and then Monday is Veterans Day, they're off. And then Tuesday, the trial will start with opening statements, and then they'll go straight into the evidence after that.
And are you going to be able to be there through the trial?
That's my hope and intent. I don't know if I'm going to be there for every day for all 4 months, but I plan to be covering it for Vice News and for our podcast.
Okay, and tell us quickly, about 30 seconds, what's on next week's podcast?
So next week's podcast is called The Federation, and we sort of trace El Chapo's rise from a kid who grew up in the sticks in Sinaloa to a guy who's one of the most famous drug lords in the world.
Keegan Hamilton, thank you so much for sharing your reporting and coming on back.
Thanks again for having me.
That's it for our show. Thank you for listening to all of it. I'm Allison Stewart. Join us tomorrow at noon on WNYC. You can also follow us on Instagram and Twitter at all of it WNYC. See you tomorrow.